And welcome to another edition of Your Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on our podcast, and we're now available on Spotify. I'm Eddie Packham, and we are massaging your ears with the aid of oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it's so VAR, so good, as Glenn Murray's late goal saw off Palace and put us through to the next round for a glamour tie against, Middlesbrough. The national media tried to whip up a frenzy of controversy about Murray's goal with a VAR system being used for the first time, but the reality was they were just desperate for something, anything, to cling on to. Something we won't be clinging on to is Izzy Brown, who limped out of the game on Monday with an ACL injury, which will rule him out for the season, and he has now returned to Chelsea. In addition, another former Chelsea player has probably kicked his last ball in anger for us, as Steve Sidwell has now been ruled out for the season. In other news, the women's team, unlike the men's team, received a plum draw in the FA Cup and will be at home to Man City on the 4th of February. Today, we travelled to a struggling West Brom side who have yet to turn the corner despite changing their manager. Long may that continue. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back a man who has grown a beard since the last time I saw him.
I think we all have, mate.
I know, and it's, of course, Matthew Potter.
Hi there.
Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
And there is a touch of Alexis Sal about this today. Apart from the fact that he doesn't have the long hair, I'll tell you, it's Mick Fleetwood.
But I don't mind any of these because my grandkids think it's Daddy Pig. So,
Granddad Pig.
Granddad Pig.
Yeah. Yes. So, just quickly, Matt, how's your season so far? You know, our first in this ridiculous circus that is the Premier League. How's it been for you?
It's good. I'm enjoying it more than I thought I would.
Yeah. Because yes. I mean, last time you were in, you
hated the Championship.
No, you hated us doing well.
I hated last season. I didn't hate us doing well. I just wanted to get it over and done with and get promoted.
All right.
And it was good. And I'm enjoying this season more than I thought. But I have to say, all the games, all the big games, really, as someone who does all the away games, all the big grounds, have been a pretty massive disappointment, really. I mean, I expected Arsenal to be.
The library aspect of it.
I expected Arsenal to be. But, you know, Chelsea was, Spurs was, Man United as well. I mean, I understand that we're one of the least attractive games, and
sure,
therefore people pass on their tickets, sell their tickets, this, that, and the other. But at Manchester United, I was on the tram getting to Old Trafford. There was a guy standing next to me about my age, bedecked in United scarves and hats. Mm-hmm. And there was a kid standing to the other side of me, about 19 years old, in an away top. And the first guy said to the second one, he said, "Excuse me, do you know where you get off for Manchester United?" And the other one said, "No, I'm sorry, I have never been here before."
And you think, hang, I'm a regular in comparison to you two.
I know. Well, I've been to Old Trafford twice now, which is more than 95% of my Manchester United sporting friends.
Well, you mentioned there that, I mean, we're not particularly a big draw which basically means there will be tickets available for the football tourists.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was talking to, we're talking about the Man United game there. I mean, I was talking to a local Manchester journalist, and they have various photos and stuff, stock images which they use, and they can't use a lot of the ones from when they play against teams like Brighton, because of all the amount of half and half scarves, they can tell exactly what game it is.
Yeah.
Are you talking about a sort of a generic Manchester United shot, you mean?
Absolutely.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's a good indication, isn't it? Because when I saw all these half and half scarves, I thought they're mad. They're never going to sell any to us. And of course, they're not trying to. They're selling it to the one-off tourists.
Correct. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's like those who keep their tickets and then frame them. You know, I was at that game. Yeah.
Well, you know, I've got a half and half scarf.
Half Brighton, half and Hove Albion.
Then one half says Brighton, the other half says Hove.
Sure. I think I just did that one.
Yeah.
Finally beat you to a gag punchline.
He's still got the day job.
Anyway, we had a big game on Monday.
Well, we had a game anyway.
It was against our fabled rivals. And if you would like to, anyone that wants to talk to us about the rivalry, don't. It was
eight changes, was it?
I think it was actually a pretty much a strong time. A strong side. I mean, the defence was pretty much as expected. Yeah, I mean, pretty much all of the team, with the exception of Uwe Hoeneman, would play for the first team this season.
And they had a reasonably strong side out as well.
Did Hoeneman not play in the League Cup?
In the League, I said. So.
Oh, right, yeah.
But I mean, it was. I mean.
Well, I say for the fact we made eight changes. Actually, I think our that 11 was still stronger than Palace's.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, the team was. Well, like I said, defence was pretty much as expected with Krill in goal, Hullemar and Golson in the centre, Bong and Schelotto were the fullbacks. Dale Stevens captained the side for the first time, and he had his old mate Berham Kyle alongside him. March and Escredo provided the width with Hemed up front, with Izzy Brown just behind. So, I mean, that's a strong side. That is a strong side.
Yeah. Well, apart from, you've probably seen Tim Krull this season more than we have.
I have, yeah.
Yes.
It makes me very nervous every time I see him, I have to say. He made me less nervous. He didn't really have anything much to do against Palace this time.
Not really, no.
I saw him playing in an under-23 game where he was absolutely terrifying.
In what way? Drop seat, can't kick it.
He was responsible for both the. I can't remember who it was now. It was lost in the midst of times, but a mist of time. But it was like, you know, what I came out of it thinking that Nicky Mampa must have done something really horrible if that guy's our number two. You know,
right? So we know who our. I mean, when you sign the likes of Tim Krull, he's not going to expect to come here to be the number three goalkeeper. I mean, obviously he was told up front, listen, you're not going to be the first choice goalkeeper, and yet still came. Well, it's not like you just want to avoid the circus that is Newcastle United.
Well, in an interview prior to the Palace game, Tim Krull did actually say that since he's arrived, Matt Ryan has upped his game and he's improved tenfold.
So he's because of the pressure. So Matt Ryan's upturn in quality and performances is down to Tim Krull, you reckon? So again, we're partly back to Nicky Mampa, who we know is actually, I think we've all seen as a pretty decent goalkeeper. You just think, is he a bit part player? I mean, is Kasper Ankergren sort of ever going to, is Michelle Kuiper's going to come back? You know, it's poor Nicky Mampa. I mean,
I feel a bit sorry.
I mean, before we signed Matty, I would have been more than happy to go into the season with Nicky as our first choice goalkeeper because I think he's everything that I like in a goalkeeper.
Absolutely, but by the same token, you do have to have a goalkeeper with, a certain amount of experience. This is a fellow who had played in the top division in Spain and in Belgium. So, with Matt Ryan, you can understand why he was signed. And to be honest, he's proved his worth, I think, sort of several times over.
Yeah.
Back to the game, though. I enjoyed it.
I very much enjoyed it. But one person that didn't enjoy it was Izzy Brown, and he only lasted 6 minutes.
He did. The second tackle, I thought, why did he do that after the first one?
Yeah.
He was flying around. He was flying into tackles. He was hungry for
he
it.
He was.
We were watching him in the warm-up. And you know what? He had a foot like a traction engine. He was putting the ball in the top corner.
Well, so did the other bloke, sadly.
And this was putting the ball in the back of the net in the warm-up. He was absolutely fantastic.
Well, he has on a couple of occasions shown what he can do, hasn't he? And I was hoping that this was going to be another occasion where he strutted his stuff. So,
and the indications from those first
was that he was going to
in that game.
Yeah, it was a great shame. I did, however, think when I saw the team sheet, I thought if I was Sam Bulldog, I'd be onto my agent saying,
yes,
look, I can't even get a game in the
FA Cup against
anymore,
Palace.
So,
yeah.
But he did get on.
He did,
and he showed exactly what we've been missing to a large extent.
Don't forget, we're playing against a Palace side who certainly seems very uninspired and under motivated.
Do you think a lot of that had to do with us knowing what the draw was beforehand?
No, because that is severely unprofessional.
Well, no, I don't think so. I'd like to think
Are you
not.
Saying that it's sort of like, oh,
everyone
oh,
just goes,
Burrow,
oh,
so
God, I don't
bother,
want to go to
yeah.
Barrett. Well, all the fans are doing that, so I suppose maybe the players do as well.
Well, let's not beat about the bush here. That was a strong Palace side. That was pretty much...
It was a strong
absolutely.
Side.
It was only really Zaha that was missing from that team. Well, and Benteke, but Benteke has been missing for most of the season anyway. He hasn't been on the pitch.
Well, I think that the thing that seems to just be most important, and I think it's the case that, we've been talking about so many times, is that we just played with, well, not so much quickly, but just a bit further forward. Witness the first goal.
Yeah.
It was Dale Stevens got into the box. You think, there's nosebleeds and...
I don't think I've seen him do that all season.
He hasn't. Certainly hasn't.
No, I'm sure.
I do like your line about sort of, the invisible supermarket line where over which he won't function. It's...
But I mean, there was a lot about Dale Stevens' performance on Monday that was down to having Berham Kyle alongside him, and it was like the band was back together again. And
a little bit, but don't forget, Kyle is a forward-thinking player. He's if you're talking about the fact that Stevens and Proper are there to sort of be quite defensively minded, then fine. But if Kyle is then brought back in, you assume that he's going to be the forward-bursting player, and Stevens will sit back. And he did a few times.
But they're so used to playing with each other, and to great effect. And it is almost dynamic midfield pairing. I'm
not getting excited by that.
Are you not?
Give
me a reason why.
Because I think that when you see Stevens and Kyle playing in a cup game that, let's be frank, nobody would have been heartbroken if we'd lost. Yeah. They're not playing under the strict discipline that they're playing in, under the league. I mean, there are certain players who are playing under. You can just see it. And Proper is one of them. I mean, Proper likes to come forward and break and do the thing that Stevens was doing on Monday night, but just doesn't. You're right about the supermarket trolley. He's absolutely got that. And so Stevens, coming from the manager, and you can see they're playing under strict instructions. I suspect if Proper had been playing in that game with Stevens and given license to push forward, you would have seen him doing it. I think that Proper and Stevens do exactly what they're told, and they do it very well. It's not particularly exciting, and I'd like to see them able to do more, but I think they're playing.
It's against the likes of West Brom today that you'd like to think that, you know, that's the opportunity that we have, that one of them will actually go bombing on a little bit.
I think against teams like West Brom, it's we've got to take the shackles off.
Yes, and even if just one of them goes forward. I mean, to be honest, if they play like Kyle and Stevens did, and they weren't exactly kamikaze against Palace, but if they did that in a Premier League game, I think you could consider it kamikaze. Yes, we're a bit more adventurous. And I am still of the mind that whilst this is our first year in the Premier League, we've got to remember that even the likes of West Brom have the ability to pick us off at the back if they feel like it. So I can understand Houghton's conservatism to a point. It's not fun to watch. And when you get the, I'd like to think we'll play exactly the same way against Palace as, you know, against Middlesbrough. You know, quite open, quite fast, quite exciting. Boss the game, miss more chances than you could throw a stick at. And like I say, it's good to get a win, but dear God, do we need to learn some shooting practice?
But at West Brom, he's going to play exactly the same way. He's going to play to keep the team sheet. He's going to play for 70 minutes.
Yeah,
fairly dully, and he's going to hope to sneak one at the end. And to be fair, this comes back to the thing that I would imagine you talk about every week. If we had a striker, that would have worked really well this season. If we had a striker, we'd be pretty much safe by now, because it's not that we haven't created chances.
Well, let's talk about the goal then. And a lot of it led to the work of Sam Baldock, who brought the ball forward, but he was halted. So he passed it wide to Scalotto. He knocked the ball inside to Stevens, who continued his run, and he takes it on and fires an unstoppable shot past Hennessy, who really should have done better.
Well, if he should have done better, then Hennessy really should have done.
Hennessy really should have done better. Could be his epitaph, couldn't it?
And the point is that the Palace defence could have done that. You saw how much space Stevens had. I mean, if that was in a it's against a Premier League side that's, you know, that's still, it should be in theory fairly strong, and that was first, third tier defending. The sort of thing we got used to with Dean. He just did it. He belted it low and hard.
Everyone says a goalkeeper should never be beaten.
Yeah.
Well, it's not never. I mean, if you do it that well and that hard, then it's sometimes it's when it's close to the keeper. It could only be about 6 inches away from them, but it's at a height that your hand doesn't naturally get there. I mean,
hit his elbow in. Dale Stevens actually knew how to finish.
Well, I thought Stevens had taken touch too many.
Yeah. Touch too much.
Yeah. Touch too much indeed. But no, he clearly knew what he was doing.
No, hit the ball low, hard.
But again, Baldock, good. And Baldock does offer something different.
Yes.
He does.
Are you surprised that Sam hasn't been involved? I mean, we know he had his injury issues, but are you surprised that since he has been fit, he hasn't been, this is the first time he's been involved?
Yes, I'm not surprised that he's not a starter at all. Gross, clearly, deserves his place and should start every game if he can.
Yes.
But I have been surprised that there have been times when we've been chasing a game and he hasn't been brought on to offer something different when he's been on the bench. I mean, he was on the bench for about five games, maybe six. and didn't
he's
get
only
on
been
one...
on the bench twice this season.
Oh, was
in
he?
The league game, yeah.
Sorry, he was on. Well, he was on the bench. He was on the bench twice in a row. Didn't get on, and then got dropped from the bench.
This is it. I think he was on the bench at Huddersfield, and like I say, we never got within a sniff of it. And I think there is what concerns me is that, you know, the fans call for Sam Baldock because the others aren't scoring. You know, like someone's stock has risen just because someone else isn't doing well. It doesn't quite work.
I don't think that's fair. I think they call for him because he offers something different.
And you know, there was that school of thought a while back when people were asking if Sam Baldock's the answer. We're asking the wrong question.
Yeah.
Because people judge a striker on their goals, but they weren't actually seeing what he actually brings to the team, how he stretches the play, how he moves defenders out of the way to create more space for the likes of Glenn Murray to get into. He offers so much more than just goals. And last year, he actually added those goals to his game as well. And amazingly, Sam Baldock has never, ever played one single minute in the Premier League.
No.
Even when he was at West Ham.
Oh, yeah. Blimey. And also, he is probably one of our most mobile forward, our most mobile forward players. Because once Knockaert's on the ball and he's on one of his runs, everyone else just stands still, not having a clue what he's going to do next. So,
but the thing is, I mean, if he is on the bench and when you're making changes, if you're taking off Glenn Murray and putting on Tomer Hemed, you basically it's like for like. Yeah. It's not going to change anything.
Which case, who would you have Sam Baldock start in place of?
I wouldn't have him start in place of anyone, but when we bring Gross off, there are times when I've thought we could bring him up.
Okay. But there are people who say Sam Baldock must start. So
they may do. I think they're wrong.
Again, it depends on what formation. I mean, if you're playing two wingers with it looks like Solly March is the current incumbent.
Yeah.
But my preference would be to have Izquierdo and Knockaert as the wing.
Right.
But
would it? Do you think Izquierdo's done enough?
I think he's beginning
he's
to
getting
settle.
Better.
He's getting better, definitely.
Yes. And people do forget it's a new country, a new game, completely different environment. It does take
to Belgium.
It's shooting fish in a barrel.
My worry is that he's found that what he did in Belgium doesn't work here.
Quite.
And has not discovered any alternative. Hasn't got a plan B.
Yeah. So, maybe it's either that or just doing as he's been told.
Okay. Well, we created a lot of chances there. I mean, there was another one that Solly March really should have scored a header that he just basically headed straight to the goalkeeper, basically. But
there was a horrible Baldock miss. There was a horrible Kyle miss.
Oh, yes.
Well, we'll come to that in a minute. Palace did equalise through Sacco. And if that was
them how to shoot,
if
frankly.
If it was anyone but Palace, we would say, oh, bravo, sir. But
I'm going to say bravo, sir.
Yeah, I did. We did say bravo
yes,
for that one.
That was a very good goal.
It was, yeah.
It stayed hit, didn't it?
Really did.
Yeah, and actually bent away slightly from Crawley. I mean, I don't know if it was apparent, but it slightly bent away from him. So even if he could have sort of scrambled a bit further, it was still going, right, okay, you've got it. No, I'm going to bend a bit further. Yeah. No, it was perfectly hit. And just showed us, you know, how it should be done. And to be honest, I think it was the only Palace player who's really trying, frankly. Yeah.
Now, there was some neat interplay, and it led to March squaring for Baldock, who shot cannons off the post. But the move is kept alive by Kyle, who has the chance to score, but blazes over from 10 yards.
That was a horrible, horrible miss. It wasn't just from 10 yards, it was by 10 yards.
I can see what he's trying to do. I mean, I'm going to give...
Really?
I'm not going to be too down on him. He had there's a lot of players on the line. They have two players rushing at him at speed. And what he was trying to do is lift the ball above the defenders on the line, and he lifted it over the bar. I mean, there is an argument. Yes, he could have blasted it, and it might have taken the deflection and gone in, or there might have been someone to put it in. But I can see what he was trying to do. Didn't do it.
First things first, aim for the target.
I'm sticking for it. And shortly after that, he played the ball of the night. Which I'm still purring about.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, and this is why I'm saying I would personally like to see Kyle play ahead of proper. Right, so where were we? March was brought down 30 yards out, and his angled free kick finds ahead of Hunemeyer, which is heading in, but Murray made sure by bundling it in. Now, this is where the VAR thing comes in. They're absolutely desperate for something.
VAR came in with all three goals. It did. You could see the referee just, I mean...
Did he signal for it?
No.
I want to ask a question about this.
Go on.
Because I thought that the way that VAR worked was a bit like cricket, the cricket appeal. So if the referee wanted VAR to be used. He would signal.
Yes.
And VAR would be used.
Yes.
And then he would get a report from the referee in New Delhi or wherever he is, who would tell him that...
Not quite. I think it's more along the lines of what we get to realise is that... You saw it with each of the three goals. He stuck his finger to his ear as if to say, was that all okay? Is there anything that you've ever seen? But what happened was the third goal went in and there was nothing untoward that the Neil Swarbrick in this instance saw. So to his mind, the goal was no more contentious than the other two, in which case, no, fine, play on. But because Palace, somewhere down the line, had believed there might have been use of the arm, their actual thing is, you should look at it again. But what it is that Swarbrick will be telling Andre Mariner in this case, have another look at this, I'm not satisfied. But Swarbrick was saying, no, I'm satisfied with this. So in that sense, VAR was used. It's just that it wasn't the referee on the pitch who was checking what had happened. It was the
There wasn't the whole movement across to go and look on the screen on the side. But, I mean, apparently...
This is what I want to know. So what happens if the on-field referee has said, I've got no problem with that, it's a goal.
Yeah.
And... just out of the goodness of his heart, the referee off-site decides he's going to have a look at it.
Yes, no, he's doing that, and he'll then put the message across to the referee on the pitch saying, have another look at this. Because at the end of the day, it's still the referee on the pitch that makes the final decision.
But amazingly, if a player goes up to the referee and does the television screen signal, it's a booking.
Yes, it is. As is looking over the referee's shoulder while he's looking at that screen.
Because I was reading a thing in the week when they were saying it was in Italy where they're using this, and they were saying that it's absolutely killed it because nobody celebrates a goal anymore. So you know that excitement that you get when a goal goes in no longer exists because the goal goes in and immediately everyone just. Looks at the referee and waits for the replay.
Well, I think that in this instance, that because certainly the first two were just in no way contentious in any way at all. You know, there couldn't have been. There was no offside issue. There was no this. There was no that. Then there was the third one. You know, by the time that the Brighton team had bundled the ball in, Glenn Murray is satisfied he hasn't handled it, so he's just gone bang in there. And I don't know if he was thinking, oh, well, if I did handle that, VAR will pull me up and I'll stop celebrating. But... it's along the line. I think that the main part of it is, and I'm with Martin Samuel on this from the Daily Mail, saying just how embarrassing the Palace players were by putting the pressure on the referee when it maybe hadn't occurred to them that actually they already have had a look at it and they're satisfied with it.
I'm not a big fan of it. I can say
I'm not a big fan of it.
It's just another sign.
We haven't had an example of what its worst aspects could be. We haven't had an example of it at the game on Monday at the Amex. So we're kind of...
Was football that bad beforehand, though?
No, I mean, I don't think so.
Just put faith in the referee that's on the pitch and let's have something
to talk
about in the pub
afterwards. The interesting thing about it was actually the opposite of what happened. Was if you looked at one of the camera angles, it looked like it had come off Murray's arm. If that had been the referee's view, the referee may well have blown up.
Yes.
Or not given the goal. In which case, VAR would have then been able to say to him,
actually, I'm not sure it did hit his arm. Have another look at it.
Yeah,
but therein lies the issue, isn't it? I mean, you've got the two. So I think Rio Ferdinand's point was actually even more telling. He said it's inconclusive. So therefore, if it's inconclusive, you go with the referee on the pitch's original decision.
It asks more questions than it answers. That's the problem.
Yeah, and I think that it's going to take the kind of spontaneity out of a lot of...
The thing is, it clearly didn't on Monday. It was used, but it wasn't used in that sense. So in that sense, it had a fairly sort of mundane birth. But yes, it will kick in further down the line.
Well, we'll draw a line under that now and you know, we'll look at it again if we have to. But you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB and on our podcast. We are, of course, brought to you in association with oldfootballshirt.com. And I've got a bit of a minger coming over. If you could describe that one for me, Matthew.
Well, I can. It's a Puma shirt. It's a kind of, I was going to say white, but it's a kind of silvery white.
Very sheeny, isn't it?
Very sheeny indeed, with a red square in the middle, some writing of sorts, which doesn't appear to make much sense. Could that be a 3, a 7, and an arrow thing, and a
looks
U?
Looks like 3, A, U, 7.
And then some...
Is that
stars.
Purple star, purple V, and
purple
with some
V, yeah,
silver
with some
stars,
silver
and
stars, and on the arm. So
it looks like
United Arab Emirates.
It looks like something that Fiorentina would wear if they ever became an American club. Above and beyond that, not a clue. Not even going to guess.
Right. Can you, do you want to have a guess at the year?
'93.
Really? It could be. I'm going a bit earlier.
Go on, mate.
Go on.
I'm going 86.
Not quite. Okay, let's have this one then. It's bonkers, says Phil. This is the 89-90 shirt, away shirt of Austrian side FC Admira Wacker Mödling, nickname Admirana. They play in the Austrian Bundesliga and they finished sixth last season. Their home ground is the 10,600 capacity Bundesstadion Südstadt. They are a bit of a Frankenstein's monster of a team. After a merger in 1905 between the two Viennese sides, Burschenschaft Eintracht and Sportclub Windumbona, they took the name FC Admira. God for that. Then in 1971, they merged with the SC Wacker Wien. And since 1997, with VfB Mödling, most recently a merger with SK Swaderdork in 2008.
That's an awful lot of mergers here, isn't it?
I know. It's frightening. And the current name evolved. I trust you all kept up with that. One incarnation of another side that has won the Austrian League on 9 occasions together with a handful of cups. Most recently, in 1989, they won the Austrian Super Cup. There is a cracking link between Admira and the Albion.
Go on, then. Please don't tell me it's Ashley Barnes.
It's not. Who can... Oh, you just guessed Ashley Barnes is not. But a certain Gordon Smith played for the side in 86-87, making 38 appearances and scoring 6 times.
So luckily for him, he would never have worn this shirt.
No.
He'd have looked stunning in that shirt.
No, really.
And he would have scored and then he'd have missed a sitter.
No, it's... any particular reason why Phil chose that one?
Because he likes it.
Really?
Yeah,
it's horrible. It looks like it does look like an American football shirt.
It does look.
It
like doesn't
look like well. It does look like an American soccer shirt of the national team, which they used to have some.
Yeah, they used to have Stars and Stripes on the shirt. Yeah,
but okay. But I mean, obviously, with us playing Palace this week, just gone, there were certain issues about obviously with the policing of this game and the last game. Now, Al, you caught up with
I did catch up with Darren. He came into the Reverb Studio at the Open Market earlier this week. And I had lots of things to ask him, but I started by asking him how much Sussex Police and the club go about making arrangements specifically for the Palace match.
Well, what we do, we go back when the fixtures come out in June, actually March, April time, we get the club get a fixture schedule for next season. Mm-hmm. Doesn't say who you're playing, but it tells you the dates of the games, match day 1 to match day 38, obviously with the Premier League. And we get asked then, club get asked and we get asked if there are any dates we want to avoid, local rivalries on certain days. We stipulated and we asked the club to put Crystal Palace to be a midday kickoff on a Sunday.
This is before the fixtures came out?
Yes,
you asked for
absolutely,
it.
Yes.
Okay. When you say we, do you mean Sussex Police or was this in conjunction with the Met? Or
No, it was. I don't have any say in the away games.
Okay.
So the home force will have to make their own representations with their club for any games which Brighton are involved in. So with this one, we try and avoid things like Pride, mm-hmm. Peel, which is Lewis Bonfire, our operation name for Lewis Bonfire.
And knowing
that we could be in the same league as Crystal Palace, we had Crystal Palace on a midday Sunday the last time.
2013, yeah.
Yeah, and that by and large went well. So we wanted to replicate that this time.
Okay. So what happened that it wasn't put there? Is it just one of those things that you think, well, this is what we wanted, but we're not getting it? Or
The issue we had, they gave us a midweek fixture.
Mm.
So that means there was a game on the Saturday, so we couldn't move it to the Sunday because there were already a league fixtures on the Saturday.
Sure.
And then it was obviously the following Saturday. And it happened to be the first midweek game of the Premier League.
Right.
So the Premier League has no midweek games up until the 28th of November, and the first midweek game we had in the Premier League was Crystal Palace. Now, a night game is better than a Saturday game from a policing point of view. It's not ideal, but...
A night game on a working day, you mean, rather than, a weekend game?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. But we had no wriggle room. We couldn't move it. We can't say, as a police force, we can't say, we don't want that game on the 28th. we want it moved to a Sunday, because you look at the schedules, when would they have played it? It just wasn't possible, so we were stuck with what we had.
Sure. All right, well, like I said, we are going to concentrate here on what happened that day, and I do appreciate you coming in to explain things. So, irrespective of what later happened, did you receive any specific intelligence as to what certain groups on either side or individuals were planning?
What I wanted to concentrate on the night was engagement with supporters before the game. Now, what we did for the game in 2013 was we had a supporters group meeting, and we invited official supporters groups and also, I would call them unofficial supporters group, I mean like a representative from North Stand Chat.
Okay.
We had a look at the coach companies and the coach groups that travel to away games with Brighton, mm-hmm. and get represented from them. Similarly, we did that for Crystal Palace as well.
Invited Palace fans,
including the Homesdale Fanatics,
okay.
the safety officer from Crystal Palace, the operations manager, and the safety officer from Brighton, my boss, and the match commander who was going to be looking at the Amex on the day.
Hmm.
To talk about intel is something which we would never talk about in public in regards to what was going on, but it formulates the plans that we have for policing, and we share a certain amount of it where it affects the club, so that the club can look at it from a stewarding point of view. Intel is a fantastic thing at times, but it's almost imprecise. And if you concentrate on specific intelligence, you actually miss the bigger picture of the fans that want to come to the game and actually watch the match. So my take on it and my advice to my bosses was, what we want to do is we want to, A, speak to the fan group so they can pass on what we want to achieve, because a goal commander for the police will always set out a number of objectives.
Mm.
So it's almost put the objectives on the table. This is what we want to achieve. How do we do it? The supporters group meeting was well attended, including the LGBT groups from both Crystal Palace and Brighton
Proud
as well.
Proud Seagulls.
Yes. Unfortunately, Homesdale Fanatics didn't come.
Right.
But that is their choice.
Okay. So,
you know, it wasn't mandatory.
Did they say they were going to?
We were led to believe they were going to.
Right.
And we had email contact to let them know it was where the meeting was. And there was no representatives from the Homesdale Fanatics there. As I say, that's entirely their choice. They are a supporters group from Palace.
Mm.
And we'd be wrong not to invite them to any meeting that we did.
Okay. So you can't sort of specifically say on intel. So, you know, during the day itself, I mean, how was for you as a police officer? Where did the flashpoints start happening? Where and when?
The issue with the Brighton Crystal Palace game is people are expecting flashpoints.
Mm.
And normally the expectation is a lot less than the realisation. And we have to make sure that we police accordingly to that. So sometimes a reaction by police can cause an overreaction by supporters. That's just in any football.
Do you feel that happened that day?
No, I don't. I don't feel it happened, because what we were doing is we made sure we had police in certain areas, at the flashpoints where it could be, the railway stations, both Falmer and Brighton, Lewis. We also had officers at East Croydon, starting in the morning, to see what groups were coming down. And that's positive and negative groups. That's to allow commanders in Brighton that actually, yeah, you've got a group who've just got on the train, the fast train from East Croydon, and they'll be down in 50-odd minutes. You know, there's no issues with those people.
Sure.
We were very careful not to designate pubs, because I don't like that. I don't like saying Sussex Police say you can go to that pub. That being said, a lot of landlords and landladies didn't want Crystal Palace fans in the pub.
Are we talking ones around sort of mostly around the station here? That's what you're talking about.
Around the railway station, there'll always be home pubs. So what we did is we spoke to some landlords, and the pubs down West Street area, Yates's, Wetherspoons, tend to have away fans.
Hmm.
So we publicised that, that as opposed to saying these are the only away pubs.
There's no decent Brightonian will go to those places.
Well, because I'm sure there's lots of other pubs in the lanes or whatever. You had Crystal Palace fans in as well.
Yeah.
But as football fans like to be, you know, some football fans like to travel in groups and they like to have a good sing-song, then those pubs were quite big to do that for them.
So those particular pubs you're talking about, wherever they were in the lanes, and so there was no real major flashpoints. You know, there was Palace fans, and you know, you think, well, you know, to be kept an eye on, not necessarily because of what they're doing, but because of, you know, whatever that could attract. But you're saying that during the day until a given point, we're talking about sort of just people having a few beers ahead of the game?
When, obviously, being a night game, you get some people will take the day off or half a day off. So we had fans from both sides in the city from, I'd say, about 1-2 o'clock. Now that's an awful long time, you know, 6-7 hours. For those who want to drink, to drink. So we just have to, and this is not football policing, this is just normal nighttime economy policing, but you have to monitor and make sure the landlords and landladies are doing their bit in regards to the alcohol being served, drunkenness in their pubs.
And you say that whether they were football fans or not.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. We do that on a Friday, Saturday, you know, in the summer. It'd be exactly the same. The landlord and landlady in old money, DPS as they call them now, it's up to them to run their pubs. It's not for us to tell them how to run their pubs. It's only for us to tell them if they've run their pubs badly, and then we can deal with it through the licensing committee. Mm-hmm. But by and large, I'd say totally, the licensed premises in Brighton were excellent. The Brighton Crime Reduction Partnership, which is their pub watch scheme, were brilliant in regards to engaging with the licensees. Mm-hmm. And we had meetings with them, and we knew where we were and what to do. We knew the Palace fans were going to go down to the West Street area by and large. And they did.
Okay. Well, I got to the ground for about, I don't know, 5:30, 5:45. Most things appeared fairly peaceful outside the ground until, you know, most people had gone in. It didn't actually feel like a sort of a teeth-gnashing derby. It really didn't. But the first we knew of any issues, certainly was at the ground, was when rook scarers and flares went off inside the stadium. And my first thought was that stewards hadn't done their job properly in allowing these things to sort of like come in. But we later learned that an exit gate was opened. We've seen the sort of a quick video of that, but could you fill us in with more details to actually what happened in that incident?
What was quite interesting, you talk about the rook scarers.
Assuming they're rook scarers.
Yeah, well, they are. We've got some of them, and I was hoping to bring one along today.
Just to scare me?
Well, yeah. To show you how big they were. They're 6 centimetres.
That's 2.5 inches in old money.
And that's how big they are.
And then cylindrical, what, sort of like...
Exactly.
About half an inch across.
Good for radio, that.
Yeah, I know. Okay, it's that big. Yeah, and about half inch across and about 2.5... And cylindrical, kind of a mini tube, yeah?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So your point being is that they are, if you really want to hide them, they're undetectable.
They're very difficult with a search at a football ground without doing a full strip search and having the grounds, and obviously a steward is not able to do that, and we have to have really decent grounds to do that. You're not going to be able to. They are very difficult. We can use pyrotechnics dogs, which I know the club do, as a deterrent.
Flares and smoke bombs did get in. I mean, are they, what size physically are they before they go off?
They're slightly bigger. The smoke grenades are slightly bigger. In fairness,
and they still got through. A few got through.
Well, there was. I think there's around 9 that got let off in the stadium. We know that it was by 3 people because we've actually looked at the footage.
Right.
And 2 of those people have now been identified.
With regards to the footage that we saw of the exit gate happening and people coming in, as far as you can say, because I understand it's an ongoing investigation, what actually happened?
I'm not trying to sway this one, and I can't comment on stuff which is Brighton of Albion related. That's a safety officer side of it. We, as a police force, are there to support the club in respect of their operation. So it's something really which A is part of the investigation from a criminal point of view, but B would be wrong and amiss of me to comment on from a stadium point
of view. Okay, but what can you say about it?
All I can say is what the footage you've seen, I've seen. Mm-hmm. A number of people did get in without tickets being checked. 2 stewards were injured, some receiving hospital treatment. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, those stewards are now fine. The stewards on the night, I will say, and I've said in other meetings, did a fantastic job. Mm. They are football stewards. They're not police officers. They're not wearing the pads and the helmets that some riot cops would wear. Mm. And they don't deserve that kind of treatment that night or anywhere.
Were they Brighton stewards or Palace stewards?
There was a mixture of Brighton and Palace stewards working that night.
Right, okay.
But I don't know the exact setup of that that gate.
Okay. Well, assuming that we can accept the fact that a storming of an exit did happen, it's therefore not illogical to conclude that there was around 100 to 150 Palace fans outside with tickets, mostly with tickets, who were denied access to the stadium. Another complaint that's come across on social media is there was the element of kettling. You know, fans who couldn't get into the ground couldn't go anywhere or do what they wished to do. So whose idea was it to keep everyone in one place, and why was that done?
I'm aware there is possible civil litigation in regards to this. We've been made aware on social media by the Football Supporters Federation that solicitors have been instructed by the Palace Trust. And because of that, it'd be wrong for me to comment on it at this stage because we've not seen this letter. I checked this morning with my bosses. We still haven't received this letter that we were told we were getting. So we don't know what the complaint is yet. And until we know what the complaint is,
Do you feel that kettling, this, what we call kettling, you know, the hemming in of people, do you feel it could be part of this?
They are making, according to the tweet from Football Sports Federation, they're a letter of complaint about several points of the policing of the Palace game. I am probably expecting they will be wanting to ask questions about that area in regards to what happened there. Yes.
So the fact that there's a threat of litigation means that you can't actually comment on this?
I can't really, because it would be wrong of me to comment on that side of it. That's above my pay grade, to be honest with you, Alan. And until we know what actually the complaint letter says, I can't really go any further on that aspect of it.
I mean, can you tell me what the reason behind keeping all those fans out of the ground was?
The safety officer closed the gates.
Right.
That's the reason. The club said that the gates were now closed
because they'd been stormed earlier.
I'm guessing it was a decision made by Brighton of Albion. They've closed the gates in support. We supported that. The match commander was fully aware. We were fully aware of the conversation that I had. But the ultimate decision would be made by Brighton of Albion.
Right.
So once a safety officer, who is primacy over everything at that ground, makes a decision, then we support that. And we deal with the other side of it, whatever we have to deal with.
Because like I say, there's 150 Palace fans outside.
Yes.
And this is where then the police take over. Because when, for instance, a door... And I'm not necessarily even specifically this issue, but when the doors are closed and it's the Albion that is, or the football club decides to do so, I assume that obviously that it's done in liaison with the police, or is it just a case of, no, we've got to close the door? Then police would have to react to a certain situation, don't they?
Yeah, we're not going to hear about it after it's done. The club will be in conjunction with the match commander over every aspect, whether it be an ejection, whether it be a fire alarm going off somewhere. They will liaise with the match commander. Yes.
Okay. In the aftermath of all that was going on, and like I say, there's we're talking about the gates being sort of opened, the exit gates being opened, the people being kept in, and what have you. One of your colleagues did tweet about what was alleged to have been found on some, an unnamed number, unnumbered Palace fans. And the tweet was later deleted and an apology ultimately issued. But I think for the rest of us, and I think we'd say this as Palace and Brighton and fans of any football club, would say this is not a good example of police information giving. And worst, it was blamed on information received from the club. Bearing that in mind, how did the information come to be put into the public, and do you feel that a sense of due diligence should have been applied before posting that?
Well, we apologised twice. I think we apologised through the media, through our media department.
Your comms department.
Yeah, comms department. And Mr Barry, our ACC, apologised again before this game, the FA Cup game. I agree. At the time, I'll say it was said in good faith. Mm-hmm. The information came in. However, we've looked at the way we do our checks and measures in regards to quantifying information that comes in. Because you can imagine a lot of information comes in at a lot of time. At the time of that, there was the issues outside the away end and the issues going into the away end. That's no excuse. And yes, I would say that we have looked at the way we deal with things like that, and
it didn't exactly cover Sussex Police in glory,
no,
did
no,
it?
No, it didn't. No, it didn't. What I will say is, and I think the tweet you're referring to is from Mr. Nelson, and I'll say this: he's a good man. He's a good man, Mr. Mills, and he's a fan of football. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is he was the chief inspector that took the policing from the Withdean to the Amex. Mm-hmm. So he was, albeit I was obviously part and parcel in regards to the aspects of as the stadium was built with Richard Hebbard working alongside us. He was the command officer who made that happen from a policing point of view. And I think if we take away what happened that night, which wasn't good, mm-hmm. you think of all the other matches we've had at that stadium and the compliments we've had on the policing and stewarding. Mm. And it's testament to him.
Sure.
So it wasn't good on the night, but I will say, and I've seen on social media people thinking that the police are trying to set fans up. I can assure them, and I can assure Palace fans, Brighton fans who have come out in sympathy for Palace fans, mm-hmm. And you don't often have that,
no,
do you?
No, no,
that wasn't the case, but we put our hands up that, and we apologise for that.
As a result of the evening itself, how many arrests were made on either side through the day and into the evening? And have all those who you wish to identify, especially with the exit break-in, has everyone been identified?
On the night, I think it was 6 arrests.
Of which side?
I think 4 were Brighton, 2 were Palace. Mm-hmm. From memory, I'll have
and
to...
And was this at the ground or in town earlier?
In total.
Right.
What we did after that, we sat down with the club. The club have got excellent CCTV. We have our own evidence gathering as well. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't only the area at the South Stand. There was an area on the North Concourse with a lot of Brighton fans came to confront the Palace group as they were walking up the what we call the emergency ramp by the Memorial Garden.
Yep.
So we viewed all that. And then, thinking we'd have some time for a post-match investigation, Jermaine Genus pulls out Crystal Palace ball in the FA Cup draw, which was helpful from the point of view that we had now a...
You had an opportunity to put it right, you feel.
Well, we'd had that, but I'm more looking at finding people who have actually let their clubs down. And straight away, in my head, the timescale, I've got to get this done, or we've got to get things done by January the 8th. Mm. Because this is now the next time we're going to play Palace, as opposed to later on in the season. Mm. So working with the Met, and Brighton and Crystal Palace, myself and another colleague, we identified a number of people that we wanted their actions rather antisocial at best, should we say, criminal at worst. Mm. We worked 2 Crystal Palace games over Christmas, myself and a colleague. We worked the Crystal Palace Arsenal and Crystal Palace Man City game.
Yeah.
At those games, we identified 2 of the main protagonists for the pyrotechnics. Mm-hmm. And also at the last game, January the 8th, we identified another chap who was seen to allegedly, shall we say, because it's an ongoing investigation, use pyros in the stadium and assault a steward.
Sure.
So my message is, at the moment, although there were 6 arrests on the night and there were 7 arrests at the game just gone, we're still looking at the footage.
So were those arrests at the game just gone, were they for incidents on that evening or incidents relating to the original November game?
One of them was an incident relating to the original game.
Right. Okay, so we've read that some Crystal Palace fans were sent letters on the day saying, you're not going to be allowed into the Amex, so don't bother coming down to Brighton. Who would have sanctioned that? Was that a club or was that the police that...
Club. It's a club decision. Who goes in that ground is a club. I am
based
not,
on what information?
Well, the information would be based on the video footage, i.e. the camera work, and the identification of those people.
Mm-hmm. Last couple of questions then, Darren. What is the thinking behind the particular sort of, I'm not sure if it's clockwise or anti-clockwise, way of leaving the ground when Palace are in town?
The thinking is something we plan with the club. Again, it's a club thing, but I can definitely talk about this one. It's if we have to do a holdback for Crystal Palace fans to go to the railway station, that's the quickest way.
Right.
It is the quickest way. It's the easiest way. We've got the emergency ramp to take people down. So actually, that way is the quickest way to go.
Okay. Bearing in mind what happened, like I say, it was a pretty unpleasant sort of thing. I mean, it was nothing like as bad as it used to be in the 70s and 80s, where guaranteed fights at Hove Park after every game, even if there was only 8,000 people in the ground. But what lessons have been learned from, well, obviously you can only speak for Sussex Police, but what lessons have been learned for all of the action group who police the game? What?
I think one thing that I will speak for myself on this. One thing I've learned is the Premier League is a massive bubble. It's a massive bubble in regards to the spotlight that is put on the club, the spotlight is put in anything around it. It's headline news. I think I saw a message this morning of some of that 140, 150 journalists were in the media room or at the Amex on Monday.
On Monday for the cup game.
Just because of the VAR.
Oh, right.
And other things like that. And it is a massive media spotlight. It is a big circus. It's a circus you want to be in because it's great for the club. It's great for the city. But from a personal point of view, I don't want to change the way I police or the way I deal with football fans. The 28th was a difficult day. It was a difficult day. It was difficult beforehand and it was difficult afterwards. As you say, the club quite rightly, as is their right, viewed their opinion on what we'd done. But we do work well together. For what happened that day, what we can say is neither side of, should we say, ill intent got together. It didn't look good, but I don't want the 28th to cloud how we police the Amex in any way. I don't want there suddenly to be a knee-jerk reaction on how we police. I don't think there'll be one. We've had many meetings with my bosses in respect of how we police the Amex, and we actually look at that and think, for the last 6 years, because of how well the stewarding and the policing is at the Amex, this is highlighted quite high. Yes, we had to apologise for a couple of things that we said, and we did, and we've put our hands up to that. But actually, going forward, we shouldn't change. We've had big games there. We've had 4,500 Arsenal fans at a cup match. We've had, big championship matches, which are almost more... The tension is higher there because of the rewards going forward. And we've managed them. From a policing point of view, we have to look at not just the Amex, we look at the whole of Sussex, particularly Brighton City Centre, but Lewes, which is very popular, and other areas of Sussex. So from a policing point of view, it's a big commitment in the Premier League, but it's one that we are glad Brighton and Albion are in the Premier League, and we look forward to bigger games as well.
That was Darren Balcom talking to Alan earlier this week. Is there anything we've learned from that at all?
Well, possibly the police shouldn't have got rid of their height requirement.
ouch!
No, I'm sorry, Darren, I didn't mean that. I didn't really expect us to. I don't think that, it wasn't a great night, I'm sure, for them. They probably learnt loads from it.
Yeah,
it's certainly a lot. But the thing that interests me about it is there was earlier in the week, there was a thing about how I think it was 12 Brighton fans have been banned for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
By the club. Not this is nothing to do with the police, but by the club. And then going to have to sign,
it's all good behaviour.
Good
behaviour,
whatever they're called. Which compares and contrasts with what appears to happen to the Palace fans, which is they get a letter saying...
Don't go to the Amex.
Don't go to the Amex, here's your money back.
Yeah.
And Parrish's relationship with the HF is, I would suggest, not a very... responsible or
it's a little bit close and a little bit yeah a little bit close a little bit irresponsible. I mean, we're not getting noises out of Crystal Palace saying these people were, unless they're waiting for the judiciary to actually take its course and say these people did this and the police intend to prosecute. And as Darren was saying on that, and actually you can also listen to the full interview of that on podcast as well. That was about 25 minutes. There's a fuller one where Darren explains a lot of things in a lot more detail, even more detail, and a few more things beside, about sort of the whole judicial system, especially when it comes to football banning orders. So it could be, who knows, Palace are actually waiting for judicial process to take place.
But they do seem to have a strange relationship with it, with Parrish. And Parrish does seem to have a bit of a... I don't know what I'm allowed to say in his relationship with them. Because actually, talking to Palace fans recently, and Palace fans really don't like him.
No. Parrish.
Yeah.
Right.
So you get the feeling that Parrish is kind of desperately trying to ingratiate
himself. What's their beef with him in the main?
He hasn't done what he said he was going to do. The Americans he's brought in turned out to be kind of asset strippers rather than Canadians. Yeah. Turned out to be kind of more interested in asset stripping than investing. Right. And, you know, they haven't gone where they want to go. And,
no.
I know a lot of them were very keen on this, you know, this Chinese lot who were looking to buy them.
Sure.
Okay, well, let's move it on from there. We can't really say
like I say, these things, the due process is still going on, but the point is that Darren's come out and said, you know, this is what happened. This is, you know, to the best of our knowledge, I can tell you, this is where, and I'd say that a fuller explanation of things can be found on our podcast, also on Audio Boom.
Okay, well, let's talk about the girls for a bit. And they had another good win this weekend. A goal from a former Raw guest in the shape of Sophie Perry saw the girls win at Spurs, leaving them fourth on the table and 4 points behind the leaders.
Still
Doncaster,
very close in that
with
table.
With a game in hand.
Yeah,
and their next fixture is at Doncaster, who are amazingly, they're now managed by Neil Redfern.
Good grief. Yeah.
Which is a bit of a... I was a bit shocked when I saw that, actually. It's like... But, I mean, that's good. That's good for them. Now, the next home game for them is the... it's a big one. It's going to be... I thought they might actually move it across to the Amex for this one because might be able to get a decent crowd. But it's against the holders and league champions Man City.
It's as big as it gets in that sense. I mean, Man City are kind of they're probably on a par with their male counterparts at the moment. So it's that bigger game. Mm. Now, like I say, I think a few of us went to Brighton against Chelsea earlier in the season and saw Chelsea basically rip the Albion ladies apart.
That's a bit harsh, but...
Well,
they were better.
Yeah. I mean,
eventually.
The Albion women were lucky to get nil at that rate. I mean, you know, Chelsea were you know, they had a couple of international, you know, two or three internationals in there,
and a couple of internationals on the bench.
Yes. But it's an absolute plum tie. I'm really looking forward to going.
But
for those who've
not been to a women's match before,
it's brilliant. Love it.
This is one that you should possibly check out.
It's going to be. Sell the women's game to our listener.
Women's game. If you haven't been, I mean, I think for me that the key thing is not to compare it with the men's game.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a different game. I mean, obviously, clearly it's played with the same rules and all the rest
yes.
of it. But, you know, it's played in a different way and it has different things to enjoy in it and different things to follow. And when played really well, and that Chelsea team were pretty awesome.
Absolutely.
You know, it's really well worth watching. And Brighton too. You know, Brighton too, when they're playing well. It's well known I have a particular soft spot for Fliss Gibbons. But, you know, if you watch her play...
Yes.
If you had a man who played in her position and played as well as she did, you'd be absolutely raving about him.
Absolutely,
You know, she puts in a shift in every single game.
Your muse, Fliss Gibbons, what's her male... Who in the men's team is the closest counterpart that you could actually... Compare her to?
I don't know. Who would you compare her to?
It was something like Davy Proper, maybe? Or
no, because she... Sidwell. No, maybe not even there, because Steve Sidwell doesn't burst down the wing like she does.
So
he doesn't defend like she does.
See,
Bulldog doesn't defend like she does.
Unfortunately, we could go on about this all
night. We don't have a player. Well, the point is I'm making, we don't have a player like
I'm
that.
I'm with you.
You know, she you'll see Catcher defending on the edge of our box, and then the next time you'll catch her crossing it from the byline.
Absolutely. And that is all we've got time for. We've got to leave it there. So thank you to Matthew Potter. Thank you to Alan Wears. I'm Andy Packham. We'll see you again next week for another Albion Raw. See you soon. Bye.